Hey, my name is Amanda, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm so glad to be here. Well, I will when this part is over, but it's absolutely beautiful. I just want to thank everybody for putting this on. I was on a host committee at one point for a while in my sobriety, and I know all the effort and time and energy that goes into a convention of this nature, so thank you so much for having me. So I'll get into it. My sobriety date is July the 1st, 2012. My home group is the Iroquois group back in Louisville. Y'all come out if you're ever down that way, up that way. And I have a sponsor, and her name's Rebecca D. And I always say those things because I remember when I first came to AA and folks would get up at the podium and they would say those things, I just wasn't impressed. You know, I thought, that's all you got going on for you. Like, I thought you were going to tell me you had a mansion and a movie star boyfriend. And, you know, I don't know what's so great about those things. But now I know those things are absolutely the most important things in my life. So I'm originally from Eastern Kentucky. I bet y'all are very surprised with my accent, you know. And my first memories of Eastern Kentucky were really good memories. I remember feeling so much love. Me and my mom live with my nanny and my pap, and we were in the mountains, and they had this little farm, and they were just great people. And I also remember early on that I was introduced to concept of God. Like, we would go to church. I had no clue really what was going on, but I liked it. And the reason I liked it was that there were these men that always sat up on the front row, and they always had peppermint candy, butterscotch, and quarters, you know? And I was like, yes. And I mean, I was a little old thing, so from like a very early age, I started to manipulate. I remember I'd make my rounds at the beginning, I'd make my rounds again, and they would finally be like, Amanda, now you've came over here, you know what I mean? And I would just try to smile and be real cute, and yeah, so that was my whole experience there. But so when I was 5 years old, my pap, my nanny, she died, and my pap, you know, they were one of those old school couples, and once she was gone, he was just never the same. You know, he lived for a little while after that, but literally he was a different person. I truly believe that he grieved himself to death. And so at that time, me and my mom, we moved out, and we moved into these low-income housing apartments where I'm from. And when we moved down there, my life was different. You know, I'd always had my nanny and pap and the stability, and my mom was absolutely the best person in the world, but my mom was one of us, and she was self-professed. She just never, AA is just not the route that she took. But I remember folks coming in and out of my house constantly, and she would fall asleep a lot, and sometimes things of mine would come up missing, and I just knew things were different. You know, she was involved in some illegal activities. That's how she took care of me, and that's where all these people came in and out. So in school, it was different, you know, because at home sometimes, or a lot of the times, my mom would tell me to go to my bedroom. You know, she would try to hide me from everything that was going on, or she would, you know, sort of push me away, and I was always vying for that attention. And at school, I did really well in school, and I was that girl, y'all, you know what I mean? That girl, the teacher's pet, that was me. Oh, I cringed at that, you know, I was that little girl, and but I loved it. And I wanted to be at school as much as I could, and I overdid everything. Everything was 200%, you know. It was just sometimes what often I'm still like that, but it's enough is never enough, and especially there. So around the second grade, right before that, I started to develop some resentments. One of the very first ones was, I remember one day I was getting off the bus, And where we lived, it was called Dempsey. And like I said, it was these low-income housing apartments. And I remember the kids on the bus yelled, "Dempsey dumpsters." And it just demolished me. So I would walk. Y'all, I would get off like a mile from where I lived and walk back through the little forest back there so people didn't know. Because I wanted to live this double life. I never invited people to my house. I always tried to go to their house because I knew, you know, what was going on at my house wasn't what was going on in everybody else's. I knew there was something different. And then these folks started coming into our apartment pretty often, and they would have these badges on, and these women would have like high heel shoes and suitcases, and it was CPS workers and cops, which I didn't exactly know. I knew who the cops were, but I still couldn't wrap my mind around it, and I knew that I hated them. I knew that they were trying to take me away from my mother, and I disliked them. So there came a huge resentment against authority. And I learned a lie early. I remember they would come and ask me questions, and maybe I was coerced, maybe somebody taught me this, but y'all, I don't remember it. And I just remember lying because I had this twisted loyalty when it came to my mother. I would have done anything to protect her. Like, she was my everything. My worst fear was something happened to my mom. I remember most days at school, before school, I'd wake up before she did, and I'd have to make sure she was awake, you know, or I couldn't get on the bus. I had to make sure my mom was okay. So I hated these people. And in second grade, my mom got arrested, and I had to leave the house. She got out of jail very shortly after, but I began to get bounced around. I have two older brothers and sisters. They're much older than me. Like, I have nieces and nephews my same age, and I would go live with them for a year, go live with this one for a year. I'd come back home. She would try, and that's just how that went. But she absolutely did the very best she could. And she was such an amazing woman, like, so charismatic. Like, you knew my mother was around. I'm looking at Eric because he knows. Like, she would let you know, you know? And so around time I was, I guess, like 14 or 15, you know, my last name is the same as all my siblings' last names. So I had known that I had this father that lived in Ohio, and that he was an alcoholic, and he's a paraplegic. And I knew that he lived there, but we didn't go there because, you know, he was an active alcoholism. So around that age, I come to find out that this man who had lived like a couple of miles away from me my whole life was my father. This whole different person. And so my brothers and sisters were my half-brothers and sisters. And this was a lot to wrap my head around. And right before this happened, can't believe I forgot this part, but right before this happened, my first drink was with my mom. And I was in middle school. And I'm going to say alcohol in all its forms, and it was with her. And that was, those years of my active alcoholism was the closest I ever was to her. You know, now we had this secret, and I didn't have to go to the other room, and I got to be around her. And so that had started, and I found out this man who I'd never met. So this man was a Vietnam veteran, never been married, had no children. He knew nothing about me. So he wanted to come in. He said, "Oh, I'm going to buy you guys a house. You guys can't live down here anymore. You know, I'll move your mom in with you too if you move in. I've always wanted a daughter." You know, he was so excited. And I hated this man. And like I said, he knew nothing about me. My whole life has been a string of me being mad at people I should have never been mad at. You know, and God just never gives up because he keeps on putting them. You know, he's like, "I don't care about your opinion. I'm going to keep giving them to you. I don't care what you think of them." And so we moved into this house, and my mom's a full-blown alcoholic, and I'm on my way, you know. And so it was interesting. I remember I had a bunch of my friends over one time, and my dad became a barber after his service in the military and working in the coal mines, and he had finally talked her into letting him cut her hair. And he had cut, I mean, he couldn't have, I don't know why he did it. You know what I'm saying? Anything he did, she was not going to be happy about. And I had all my friends over for a sleepover, and here they come running. She is chasing him with scissors. Like the movie, like literally, though. I'm like, oh, God. Thank goodness my friends were on their way to being alcoholics soon. They're like, oh, no, this is cool. You know, this is fun. Right after we moved in with him, my alcoholism was really picking up pace. You know, because whenever I drank, I just remember that all of that, you know, that whole double life, you know, having to worry about what the kids at school thought, having to worry about what my mom's doing, you know, all that pressure. I was like in this pressure cooker. When I drank, I could relieve some of that. You know, even if it was just for a minute. And so I really liked to do that. And I started to do it more and more. And it worked for me for a very short time. But around, I guess it was 15-2, I'd snuck out after a football game from my dad's house. And we went to somebody's house up a holler and were drinking and doing everything in the world. And, you know, at that age, you're invincible. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was 10 foot tall, and like everybody else was fine. And the next day I ended up in the hospital. I'd had a stroke. It was horrible. You know, I almost died. And you would think that would have told me to like slow down. You know, this is not working out for you. And it absolutely did the opposite. I remember I was out of school for a while, and when I walked in, and I am telling you, y'all, like, I have worked my steps a couple times, and I still feel this way. Like, I remember walking, and this is not logical. I am an alcoholic. So I walk in, and the whole school is talking about me, like everybody, you know? That's what it felt like. And I remember just thinking, you know, I'm going to give you something to talk about, you know? And after that, I was that kid that you didn't want your kids around, you know? And at first I didn't like it, and then I'm like, oh, at least I'm somebody important, you know? At least you know who I am. So I started dyeing my hair all these different colors and started wearing black, which now is cool. Back then, in Eastern Kentucky, was not cool. You know what I'm saying? I was not cool. And nobody really wanted to hang out with me, and I thought that's what I wanted. But looking back, I know it wasn't what I wanted. You know, what I really wanted, it's like when you love somebody and you fight with them and you're yelling at them, and like all you really want for them is to wrap their arms around you and say, it's going to be okay. You know, you're not alone, it's going to be okay. So I started pushing these people away from me, and I graduated high school barely, and I remember I would have these teachers, because like I said, I used to make real good grades, and I overdid it, and I was like valedictorian in my middle school, and all these, you know, all this, Matt. I was so aggravating, y'all. And so I barely graduated, and these teachers would tell me all the time, and it was like my motto. I should have a bumper sticker, but they would say, Amanda, you have so much potential. Y'all ever heard that? That would make me so angry. How dare you, you know? And but I graduated anyway, and I met this little boy, and here I was looking all wild looking, and he wore camouflage, and he liked John Deere, and he worked in the coal mines, and he was the complete opposite of me, and I thought, here we go. Okay, so I'll get with this guy, and this will fix me. You know, this will fix me. He came from a good family. He was a good guy. So obviously, you guys know, you know, I was a full-fledged alcoholic. I got with this guy, and it was perfect. I stopped drinking, right? And so the absolute opposite happened, and I got with this guy, and I demolished him. You know, by the end, he was just as bad as I was. I ran through his life like a tornado. And during this, I got pregnant. And I thought, again, you know, this will be it. This is what I need. I'll have a baby, and I'll be everything that she couldn't be, you know? I'll be there when he takes his first steps and when he plays t-ball for the first day, and he'll be my everything. And so I was pregnant, and somehow I stopped drinking during that pregnancy, but I want to tell you that every day I was mad about it. Looking back, I was mad about it every day. But I had this little boy. Y'all, I had this little boy. I was 20 years old, and I had him, and I looked down, and it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. His eyes were this blue, but they were like a prism. Like if you look out on the ocean, right when sun's setting and it hits it just right, and you see blues and greens and browns, that's what this little boy's eyes look like. And I thought, I have never been closer to God. Like, I have never loved anything as much as I love you. And I handed him to his father, and I went and got another one, y'all, in the hospital. And that scares the crap out of me. Though that, saying that, I had to push away those feelings of guilt and shame. I have to say it, because I have to remember how powerful this is. Like a mother's love, y'all. You know, you see videos on YouTube. They lift cars up and stuff. You know what I'm saying? Like, that is powerful. And the disease of alcohol, whew, they don't care about that. You know what I'm saying? It will always win. It's a fixed fight. So there I went, off and running. But I drug this little boy with me, you know, because my mom, remember, she told me to go to the other room, or I went to my brother's or sister, you know, all that stuff. So he's with me. So I'm being a good mom, you know. So me and little John Deere guy broke up, and I met another guy, and here's the deal. Like, I didn't even like this guy. Like, we're not even friends on Facebook, y'all. You know what I'm saying? We were together for 5 years. He was into all this illegal activity and all this, and I thought, okay, this is a strategic move. A strategic motherly move. I'll go move in here, because by now I'd start getting arrested, because I would drink and want to go everywhere. You know what I'm saying? I'd go, and that's what got me in trouble. I couldn't sit at home. If I'd have set up the holler, you know, to sit there, I'll be okay. So this guy, I'll just sit there, and then he can do whatever he does, and it'll be great. Like I said, it was a rough time, you know. It was all that alcoholic romance, and we were busting screen doors, and I was robbing him, and he was robbing me, and then there was jail visits, and, you know, all that. And, honey, I don't have money to put time on the phone, you know, because I've then used it to get drunk. But it was just not a good idea. But something good did come out of it, because I got pregnant again. I got pregnant, and I thought, okay, this time, the same thing. It's like my life has been a broken record of that. This time, I'm going to do it differently. I messed up last time. Like, I know what I need to do. You know, I've always acted like I was a referee. You know what I mean? Watching, like, the playback. Oh, here's what happened. And, like, a coach, here's what you do. You know, like, managing. When I tell you managing, you, like, I should have had, like, diagrams, like detectives finding serial killers. You know what I'm saying? I thought I had it all under control. And so here's my plan. You know, I'm going to do it differently this time. And I didn't, you know. And I was 5 months pregnant with that little boy. And the doctor had given me something for my alcoholism to help me while I was pregnant, to get over all that stuff. And that morning, I just woke up. I hadn't taken what the doctor had given me, and I had got in the car, and it was me, my 5 month pregnant self, my 5-year-old son, and my mother. And I remember pulling out, and I looked both ways. We were leaving a place, and there was illegal stuff in my car, because my mother was still, me and her, like it was now, like a family operation. And I remember pulling out and looking both ways, and I didn't see anything. And I pulled out, and I see it still, and I don't know if it will ever fade. I don't think it will, but I see it like I see y'all right now. Like, I see it that clearly. And I pulled out, and a car hit my car and spun around, and another car hit. So when the cops came, they said, you know, everybody needs to be checked out. You're pregnant, you know, your son, your mother. And so we all went to the hospital, and we were in the ER, and they had the curtains, like the shower curtains, you know, so you can hear everything that's happening in the next room. So I could hear the sound, and this I will hear forever too, I'm sure. But at first it was really mild, it was really low, and I couldn't decipher what it was. And then it grew a little bit, and I thought it's somebody crying. And then it grew, and it grew, and it was wailing, and it was sobbing, and it was the worst sound, the most heartbreaking, gut-wrenching sound. And I thought, what's going on? And these two uniformed officers come in, and in the state of Kentucky, when there's a fatality, all the drivers have to submit to a urinalysis and a blood screen. And one of the drivers of one of those cars had passed away that day. So I went and did what the officers told me, and I remember at first it was like a dream, like my feet was moving. I couldn't understand what happened, because never did I think something like that would happen. And God's grace and mercy, but I still hold it with me. Like, what if somehow, like where I had been on that stuff and hadn't been on it then, you know what I mean? But none of it was in my system. But I still, like, did that have a... But anyway, so I went home, and at that point, you know, I was still pregnant, but I wanted to die. Like a part of me that day. And I worked through it a lot. And I know it was like an accident, and I know that stuff wasn't, because I hadn't been, but still, it doesn't matter. You know what I mean? Like, my feelings won't let me logically explain it to myself. A part of me died that day. Like, I have never been the same, and maybe I'm not supposed to be the same. It was the worst day of my life. It was a bad day. And so I had that little boy, and I just continued to drink. And now it was a kamikaze mission. I would have these nightmares and these flashbacks, and I thought I was going crazy, and I ended up in psychiatric wards, and it was just like that loneliness in the big book, that loneliness. I remember, because I was too scared to take my own life, and I would try these little attempts, but like just before I could really do it good, I'd get scared. But I would, because by now I had decided there wasn't a God. I had decided there wasn't one, because how is that fair? How is that fair that I'm still here? Like, how is that fair? And it was just horrible. And so my babies, I had that son, and they were 5 months old and 5 years old, and I'm so thankful for the God of my understanding. So thankful. And so they were in the bed with me, and you know, God works in many different ways, and these officers busted my door in. And they had these felony indictments for the very same crime that my mother committed years ago. The very same stuff. And remember, I said I was going to be different. And I'd like to say, when they were coming and they were handcuffing me and these little boys were scared to death and there were guns pointed at them, that I was worried about these little boys. I was worried about myself. Even after everything I did, I was worried about me. How long am I going for? Where am I going? How am I going to get out of this? And if I would have known then Because even to this day, I do not have custody of those little boys. That's not what God has for me. And if I would have known then, you know, I would have held them a little tighter. I would have told them, I'm sorry. I didn't mean for it to be this way. And I would have remembered what my five-month-old was wearing. And I would have remembered how tall my five-year-old, but I was so worried about myself. I don't remember any of that. I don't remember any of that. I didn't even think about how it affected them. And I went to county jail for a little bit, and they let me out. And I got out, and I'd lost custody of these kids, and I ran. And it got to a point that one night, and this is God too, one night I knew this night I wasn't playing, and I was going to kill myself, or I would have to turn myself in, and I turned myself in. I want to let y'all know, I have been arrested a lot of times. I have never turned myself in. I don't even cooperate, you know what I'm saying? And I turned myself in. They gave me a charge in booking. They gave me a public intoxication charge. That's how sick of me they were. I'm like, I'm not in public. Like, they just, whatever they could do at that point. And so I went in there, and I ended up going to prison. And, you know, so some folks are like, you know, I remember in early recovery folks would be like, I can do my time, you know, and I thought, yeah. Me too. And then I thought, whoa, no. You know, that really sucked. I can do my time too, but they wouldn't let me out. You know, like you don't have a choice, so it's not cool. It was not fun. I did not have a fun experience. I don't want to go back. They can keep it. That's great. And but I remember in there, and, you know, you had a choice. You could buy like commissary or you could buy socks. And this seems like a very easy decision, right? I don't know if you've ever seen what they feed you in prison, but I was buying noodles, right? So I had like these socks that had holes in them. And I would get up and everybody would be asleep and I'd walk and I could feel the concrete under my feet and I would think, this is what you deserve. This is what you deserve. And it was just the worst feeling. And so I was in there and some days I would think about, you know, did my little boy start kindergarten today? Did my baby say his first words? I wonder what they look like. I wonder if they remember me because I didn't see them or talk to them for years. And God, it hurt. You know, it hurt. And it was time for me to go up for parole. And, you know, I'm still an alcoholic, so I am delusional. So I thought, okay. This is my chance, you know, my plan. Remember, like the diagrams, this is my plan. I'm going to go in here and tell these people I'm good. Let me go home. Thank you for the stay, you know. It's time for me to go. So what I did, like any good Eastern Kentucky girl, I teased the heck out of my hair. You know, I poofed it up because the higher the hair, the closer to God, you know. They would see me and know, you know, like, oh. We have made a mistake. So they saw me, and that's not what they said, y'all. You know, they had this folder. I thought, okay, that's like my good reports of what a model prisoner I've been. And this is all my background. And there was a lot. Like I said, it was a lot. And they said, you know, Miss Hall, we think you should do a substance abuse program. And all I knew was that meant I was going to go somewhere for like 6 to 9 months, like a treatment facility. So everybody, you know, like my jailhouse lawyers had been like, no, don't go for that deal. You know, like you could plea bargain with the parole board. And I was like, well, you know, I respectfully decline that. I think I would be okay if I go home. Like I'd rehearse and everything. And they're like, okay, Ms. Hall, you can serve out the rest of your sentence. That's it, y'all. I had a total psychic change. I said, I am an alcoholic. Help me. Thank you. Send me wherever. And they did. They sent me to Louisville to a program there. I'd never been to Louisville. I'd never rode a bus. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't know what was happening. And I got there, and these these people, you know. Oh my goodness, like in prison you can't touch people, which I was like good with that. You know, I'm not very like huggy-feely. I was like, okay, this is cool. We get there, everybody wants to touch you, you know, like you're hugging and then you hold hands and they all chant things. I'm like, where do they go? Do they just like sit in rooms and study things? Like I was very confused about it all and I hated it. I thought if one more person tries to hold my hand, tell me they love me, and ask to say the serenity prayer with me, I'm running. Like I am 4 hours from where I'm from, don't know where I am, but that's enough. I'm going to abscond. And luckily I didn't, thank goodness. And I got in there and I did the bare minimum, y'all. You know, so started to drink again. Started to drink and I got away with it. Because I'm very institutionalized. I can do what you tell me to your face. You know, I'd done this, like I said, jails and prisons and psych ward all over the place. And then behind your back, whew. So they have something there, it's called accountability. So somebody held me accountable and I lied, y'all, and said I didn't do it. And you know, I thought this is a very compelling argument I've given, you know, like I had my story together. And that woman who had been in AA for a long time said, you know, I don't really care what you say. You know, like, I don't believe you. And I went back to jail. And I was in jail. And I said two little prayers, right? Because I'm like, what else? I mean, what do I got to lose? Like I said, I didn't believe in the God thing, but why not? So I said a prayer. My first prayer was to go back to prison because Louisville Metro was gross. That's how crazy I was. Let me go back to prison. It's nicer there. And my second prayer was, because I didn't think it would ever happen, let me go back to this treatment center. If you let me go back, I'll try. And the next day they came and they let me go back. And I did try. You know, I got stuck. There was a detox center there, and I was stuck in there for a real long time. And, you know, at first I hated it. And I remember these women would come in, and I got just bored enough, I would start to talk to them, you know. And I wasn't allowed to use the phone or anything, and they started reminding me of myself. Because I was just selfish enough to be like, oh, they remind me of me. This is cool, you know what I mean? But like when I would hear those, it was like God would put this mirror in front of me, and I could see it differently. Like I could see them. Like there was something different in them, and that they were savable, and they can get better. I started to believe that about them before I believed it about me. God knew it would take a minute, you know? So he gave me them. Remember, he gave me these people for a really long time. This is the first time I was open-minded enough not to push them completely away. And so I started to read the big book. Because now at this point, I'm like, okay, I'm going to show my parole officer, because I'm mad at her too. I'm like mad at all kinds of people. And I'm going to read this book, and I'm going to do what they say, and I'm going to show you that AA doesn't work. I get it. It started in the 30s, but like, I'm going to disprove it. Like, I'll have diagrams, you know, I'm going to show the world. And so I started reading this book, and it made so much sense. Made so much sense. Again, I was just selfish enough to find myself all in it. I thought, okay, maybe they wrote this for me. I can get down with that if it's for me, you know. And so I remember I was in that detox, and one day I hit my knees out there because I still wasn't finding any kind of peace. And I hit my knees and I prayed. And I didn't know what I was praying to. I just said, please, if there's something up there, help me, please. And when I was on my knees, it was on concrete. I had these really thin scrub pants on, and it felt like the concrete below my feet in prison, but it felt different. And that was enough for me because it felt different. And things like weren't perfect after that, but they started to get better. I started to listen. And I got this sponsor, and she wore cowboy boots, and she drove a truck and listened to country music. smoke winsome 100s, and cuss like a sailor. I thought, she is everything, you know? And she was amazing. She would come pick me up, and she would take me to meetings, and she had been my sponsor before I started to drink at the treatment center before, but it wasn't real, you know what I mean? Like, she was just there. So this time, she's like, all right, are you ready? I said, yeah, and we started working those steps, and it's just different. I remember one of the funniest things about her, that on that fifth step, my first fifth step, she had made it really, like, ritualistic. We had went to this huge overview, like, you can see the whole city of Louisville. It's so beautiful, and it's a park, and it was so important. The second one, we went through a McDonald's drive-thru, and she pulled to the side and ate a Big Mac while I poured my heart out. It was so funny because she said, Amanda, God's on that mountain just like he's in this car. She's like, he is everywhere. If you start looking for him out here, you're going to get real confused. You've been confused for a long time, little girl. I thought, wow, those cowboy boots make people smarter, I think. My defects were not easy to hear. They're still rough. And so we worked those steps, and she meant a whole lot to me. And I remember it was Christmas time, and I wanted to go home and see my family. I remember I hadn't seen those boys in a long time, and my PO told me no. So I went to her house, and her whole family was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walked in, and they had me these gifts. I hadn't had a gift in a long time. Nobody had bought me anything for Christmas in a long time. I'm like, I got to see what AA really was. You know, outside of meetings, like, just how amazing these people were. And so when I completed that program, I went to, like, a peer mentor's office thing there, and she wanted me to get involved, like, in service work. So that's when I was on the Louisville Host Committee, and that was a great experience. And that was also, I got a home group, and that's still my home group to this day. She used to make me shake everybody's hands. Y'all remember, I was about to go back to prison for holding people's hands. You know what I'm saying? And this woman is forcing me to go shake everybody's hand. And that's what I would do at that home group. And so it was time for me to decide, when I was done with all that stuff at that treatment center, it was really time for me to get out there if I was going to go back to Eastern Kentucky or not. I'd lost custody of my children, like I said. I literally wasn't allowed in a gas station in my whole county. So it wasn't like I had a lot of job prospects. You know, like, they were not happy with me. So I decided to stay in Louisville because I thought, I'm gonna do things differently. And me and two of my friends, we got this house. One of the women I was actually in prison with, and she took care of me in there. Like, she had the support from the outside, and she would, like, fix food for me, and she was older than me, and just took care of me. And she moved in there, and my other friend, and so I decided, okay, it's time for me to get a job. So I got three at once, you know, like any rational person would. And the first one was catering. And then I was cleaning houses with my sponsor, and I was working at this, like, counseling center. So I would have, like, a bow tie, and I would have, like, housekeeping clothes on, and then scrubs. And I would, like, have the wrong outfits on. I mean, I was just a mess. You know what I'm saying? I was just trying so hard. It was a disaster. And so I'm doing all that, and then I decide I'm going to go back to school, okay? By now, I'd finally narrowed it down to one job. And my head told me, it's like, Amanda, this is not a good ideal. You know, you don't have a lot of brain cells, sweetie. You know, like, you've hurt yourself. Like, it's not okay. And you have all these felonies on your record and all this stuff. Like, this is not a good ideal. And but the thing about, you know, back when I was drinking, there would always be this voice, right? And I would listen to it. You know, I would give in to that. But the more I have practiced my conscious contact with the God of my understanding, the more that there's this other voice, right? I won't say it's a voice, like I don't hear it audibly. It's just this feeling. And it's just this do it anyway feeling, you know, like just do it anyway. And so that's what I did. And I went back to school. And then we ended up getting a new house, and one of my roommates actually relapsed, and it just killed me. It was the one that I'd been in prison with that I cared about so much. And we ended up getting a new house, and that treatment center that I was at that I hated so bad actually had a job opening, and my sponsor said, you should try to go work there. And I did. And I worked there for like 4 years. And it was absolutely a joy. It was some of the best, most beautiful, heartbreaking, hardest times of my life. Because I watched this disease every single day. And like I said, it hurt even more because I saw that mirror. Because I saw myself in these girls. One day they would be in my office and we would be talking about their aftercare plan and their reunification with their children and what their home group's going to be and all this stuff. And the next day they would be dead. It was hard. It was hard. And I was working there, and there was this parent. I developed these relationships with these parents, and he had called me, and he had this daughter, and she had died in a jail cell. She had died as a direct result of alcoholism. They hadn't checked on her for hours, and she'd had seizures and busted her head on the concrete, and they left her there, and she was 19 years old. And he would call me and talk to me. I think that I meant a lot to him because I was alive and she wouldn't, maybe. I don't know. Maybe I was a mirror. I don't know. And he told me, he said, Amanda, I just wish somebody could do something about this, you know, could help and, you know, about all this stuff with the Department of Corrections. I was like, me too, you know, me too, but I'm a felon. You know, I would love to be able to go in there and help and, you know, try to make a difference or help with laws. That would be great, but I'm a felon. I kid you not, the next day I got an email, and it was to be passed along to other people, and I read it, and it was all about, like, this criminal justice reform and how to treat people with substance use disorders and how to change laws and how to, all this stuff. And on that application, it said, individuals with a criminal record, with criminal records, are please apply. Y'all hear me? Remember, like, that criminal record was like the thing that was the worst in everything I did. And it was like, please apply. And I thought, oh my goodness. So that's what I did. And that's what I do now. And I try to do. It's a very hard job. So I graduate from college next Saturday with my bachelor's degree. And I get those two little boys. 2 weekends ago, the baby, who is now 9, that's the first weekend he got to stay with me. Well, the first night he's got to stay with me since he was 5 months old. I had him and my 14-year-old, who were under the same roof with me. The last time, do y'all remember, they had guns pointed at them because of my actions. And now because I fought so hard, they got to stay with me in that house. That 14-year-old, he gets to come stay summers with me. We get to go to the beach every summer. I have a fiance now, and we take care of his 2 children. Their mother is, she's having some difficulties. I won't call her one of us, but she's having some difficulties, and it's so hard. It's so hard because they want her so bad, you know, and it makes me think of what I've done, and, you know, and sometimes I feel really guilty. Like, how could I be able to take care of these children when I can't even take care of my own? And that's when God, again, he's like, Amanda, I do not need your opinion. You know, this is what you're supposed to do right now. And I love those little boys. So, you know, that car accident happened on December 9th. And that was like the worst thing that ever happened. The following December 9th, because my God is just, I mean, God is like pretty awesome, right, y'all? And so that December 9th, that was the worst day of my life. The December 9th after that, I was actually in a jail cell and I was detoxing and I thought I was going to die. It was the worst thing. And then the December 9th after that, I got out of prison on that day and went to treatment. I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous on December 9th. The December 9th after that, it was time for me to do my steps 8 and 9 with my cowboy boot wearing sponsor, you know. And I didn't know how to make that amends. It was a horrible day. And I was a caterer in that treatment center, and we served all these big fancy schmancy people. And we sat at this table, and the founder of that place told us all to stand up, the servers to stand up. And people started to clap. And I just felt God, like, you are right where you're supposed to be. Like, this is what you do. This is how you make an amends. You try to help everybody around me. You know, you tend to my sheep, little girl. That's what you do. And so December 9th after that, I was sitting in a college classroom and I took my first final exam. And December 9th after that, my sponsor said, you need to quit it. You know, like, this is not going to be some Amanda parade. You don't own this day. Like, God don't owe this to you. I was like, okay. So nothing spectacular happened. I got up in this house with my name on the lease. I said my little morning prayers, and I was sober. I wasn't in prison. I wasn't trying to hurt nobody, and got my little car that I worked real hard to get. At the time, it was about to give up on itself, but it got me where I needed to go. And I went to that treatment center, and I saw these women walking the halls. And I went on to class that evening and sat in a college classroom. I was trying to be better for myself and my kids. And that night, I went to my home group, and we stood in a circle, and we said the Lord's Prayer. I mean, that's daggone fireworks and parade, y'all. I mean, that's a pretty good day. This last year, well, since December 29th has been the hardest. I'll say this and shut up. The hardest of my sobriety. On December 29th, that mom that I love so much, she had been really sick. She had COPD, and she came to stay in Louisville for a little bit, but it was too big of a city for her. She told me to take her back to Kentucky. I was like, Mom, this is Kentucky, but you know. And so we had spent Christmas. We traveled down there, and we spent Christmas with her, and we came back to Louisville, and my sister called and said, you need to come home. She's in the hospital. And when I got there, the doctor said, she's not going to make it through this. You know, she's not going to make it through this. So we're going to put her on hospice. And then I got to be in that hospital with her. It was so hard. And at the end there, she couldn't talk. She didn't really wake up because she was in so much pain. They had to give her stuff. But before that happened, she told me, you know, because my mother had become religious, that's what helped her. And she told me, go get my Bible. Go get my Bible. I need my Bible under my pillow. We went and got that Bible and put it under her pillow. And that same night, while I held her hand, my mother passed away. It hurt. Tore me up because she deserved a better life. But I think she went out of this world with a lot of peace. It still hurts. A couple months later, that friend that I had from prison, my best friend, that was my roommate. I got a call in the middle of the night that she had overdosed and died. And, killed me. Because these people were just vanishing. And, I went to her funeral, and her 17-year-old just held me It was so hard. A very short time after that, somebody that I loved very dearly relapsed. It felt like my world was caving in. I felt so alone. And just a couple weeks ago, my niece, the one that I was very close to, like I said, they're my age. They're like my brothers and sisters I live with. She's 4.5 months pregnant, and she fell and broke her neck. And while they were doing the scans, they found out that she had breast cancer and it spread to her spine. She's 32 years old with 3 little boys. And that's where she is right now. And I pushed God away for a minute. I just couldn't understand. And I came to see that it's not really for me to understand. It's when things like that happen, it's for me to seek Him. And here lately, that's what I've been doing. With the desperation of a drowning man, I have been seeking God. And I haven't had to drink. You know, I haven't had to drink. On Monday, I'll go back up to the hospital to see my niece on her first day of chemo. And I'll talk to that little girl who lost her mother. And I'll be a sibling to my sisters who lost their mom. And I'll be everything I wouldn't for a long time because God had walked me through it. This program works, and I'm so grateful for it. And I'm grateful for y'all listening to me. And that's it. My name's Amanda. I'm an alcoholic.